We believe that only a challenging reality provides a rewarding existence. Only a challenged intelligence will adapt and grow. This is one of the many open questions around perception and reality explored in a modern but classic space opera, Three Immortals by Bert Oliver Boomer. Let's get this book and done. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Books Undone. I'm your host, Livia J. Elliott, and today we are resuming the Author Spotlight series. Let me introduce you to my guest, indie author Bert Oliver Boomer. Thank you so much for coming to my podcast.
Hello, Livia. Thank you for having me today. Very much appreciated. Very excited to be here.
Yeah. Will you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Absolutely. Bert Oliver Boomer. I'm the author of the Galacticide series of distant science fiction novels. They are epic space operas with a healthy dose of military sci-fi.
It was actually very, very military. I love that. But before we get started, let me tackle the usual disclaimers. Three Immortals is a standalone book in the Galacticide universe, and so we will focus our conversation on this specific entry. Although there may be some spoiler light for this book, we will still clear of the others. Second, remember that what you will hear is our subjective opinion on these topics. You may disagree, and that's okay. Now, there are so many things we could discuss about this book in particular, but something that I really want to dive into first is the first contact, which is actually like second contact, according to the book lore, that happens in this book. There are two alien species, the Tras and the Isonomy, which are also known as those staying behind. And something that I particularly loved is how non-human they are. A lot of science fiction and fantasy end up having races that are somewhat human in custom or in appearance, in traditions, but in here they are markedly different, and not only in appearance, like the whole cultures, the whole perception of the universe is also different. So to get us started, will you share some of the details of each species and what inspired you?
Oh, absolutely. I like my aliens as alien as possible. I believe that in sci-fi, especially sci-fi pop culture, our impression of what aliens look like or can look like has been mostly derived from TV shows and movies, starting with classic shows from 50s, 60s, 70s. And they, of course, had a limitation in terms of budget and what was possible. How alien could the aliens really look like? Well, they would always end up having two legs and two arms and look very humanoid. And at least Star Trek in the later shows made an attempt to explain this away in shows. So I very much appreciated that. But I believe in literature, you have this wide open playing field, how aliens can look like and how they can be structured from what is their appearance, how does the body function, how do they communicate, how do they live their daily lives, what's their culture like. You can add so many different nuances, you can pour in so many different ideas that I think it's a waste to just end up with a humanoid. So my aliens are very much that. They're extremely alien.
Yeah, and to some extent, they also have conflicts about how they understand each other because of how different each of the races is from each other.
So the first contact in the book, as you mentioned, or the first contact, I should say, the protagonist has with them, because they've been discovered before, and then this has been forgotten in history. But we travel mostly with the protagonist, and when he meets them for the first time, there's no universal translator. So just establishing a baseline of conversation is a major undertaking. It's tackled with high tech, but even these advanced civilizations, it takes them a while to come to an understanding or common ground. One example would be when my protagonist asks the alien he meets about certain time frames, and that he's talking about, oh, this was very recent and other things were a long time ago, and the alien responds in a nonsensical way until the character realizes maybe these guys live a really long time, and maybe for them a short time is a completely different time scale. And then he finds out that the guy who is talking to is older than the human species as an individual. When he was born, the humans were not around yet. And then it dawns on him, oh, when he says a short time, this could be thousands of years.
I actually loved those quote-unquote misunderstandings, because the first time Drar says it's just a short time and he waves it off, then we realize that Kel, that's the main character, that he's been, I don't know, I think it was almost like 6 months, roughly, for the impression he has. And at the end of the book, what I found pretty interesting was a change in him. Like, whenever the others will say it's a short time, he was already, okay, I need to be thinking about 10 years, 100 years. So his own perception changed to adjust to the Drass in particular. And I also liked that whole scene in which we have Rar and Kel sending Miru, which is from those staying behind, to negotiate. And he comes back in 8 ticks, and then he says, like, that's the longest we took to negotiate. And then again, it was Rar was expecting that something so important will take so much time because his civilization is long-lived. But the other civilization is also long-lived. But it's an AI, so everything happens very quickly to them.
Yeah, the Miru is one of the representatives for the Isonomy, the machine civilization in the book. You're absolutely right. They're as long-lived, you know, with proper maintenance of their core bodies, like the Tras, the Silicates. But their perception of time, of course, is completely different. And I know the scene you liked, it's they negotiate something internally and it just takes them a few fractions of a second. For them, it was a really long meeting. And when they meet with the entire civilization. So all cores get linked together at the same time. They are sort of a true collective democracy. There are no leaders. There is no hierarchy. All the cores meet, they discuss whatever needs to be discussed, and then they decide very efficiently.
It's also like, if they decide it, they will do it. There is no black and white in their decisions, or at least that's how Miru presents it. Like, if that link, as he calls it, makes a decision, that's it, it's final. And that was something the other two species, so the humans and the Tras, they couldn't understand how or why there wouldn't be any disagreements afterwards.
They stick to their decision, absolutely, which, of course, for human politics is unthinkable. Of course, the humans are also a big faction in the book. Ultimately, as a science fiction author, you always have to tie in the human experience, right? Because that's how we can relate to things. I believe it's important to show really exotic ideas, concepts, material, cultures, but you cannot completely cut out the relatability. And of course, a human protagonist will help with that. The human politics in the book, of course, are a lot messier, a lot more complex. So for them, this concept of, yeah, we all decide, we all agree, and then we all do it, is truly alien.
Yeah, it's something that we humans aren't capable of. We go more for the individualism rather than that collective approach. What I really liked of the Isonomies was that even if they had this link and this collective way of deciding, they were also individuals. Like, they also had individual thoughts.
Yeah, the machine civilization, of course, is always tricky. Either you construct them from the get-go as individuals, they're not well-connected, they're not a hive mind, they don't have the equivalent of what I call the link. If you think about the landscape of different androids in big franchises like Star Wars, they all differ a lot. They range from really sophisticated machines to basically power station with two legs and everything in between. It is tricky to not have the other extreme, right, where they're all like uniform drones and kind of boring this way. I wanted to have the uniformity, so they all look the same, they all have the same specifications from the build-up, but their personality, the quantum computer, the matrix that basically construes their personality is different from core to core, and they still have different likes and wants and aspirations, and they do have different talents. Like Miru, the core that we meet, well, the most and get to know the most in the novel, he's a shipbuilder. So why did he pick shipbuilding over something else? Well, it's something where he feels like he can contribute to his society the most, and he has a talent for it.
Even if they had this way of organizing themselves always to help society and to contribute, they also had quote-unquote factions, especially with the ones that actually chose to follow the prior invaders, the ones that caused the Galacticide. Those staying behind, which is the other name for the isonomy or how they call themselves, they chose that name, those staying behind, because they were not... They don't see themselves as part of the other faction. They even had like a completely different mindset. It was pretty interesting because I think almost every species tends to have factions or division among them, even though they had this link and connection and what we decide is what we do, they still had that type of disagreements.
Yeah, they can disagree. And of course, what they disagreed on there was big. It really caused a schism in the civilization. Our hero Kel, he learns about this during his first contact situation, but it is history. It happened centuries ago from a human perspective, where the isonomy, the machine cores, split in two, and one chose basically slavery as a means for survival. There is an extragalactic civilization invading. They are about to destroy all of them, and they basically offer themselves as, we'll work for you. We'll put our machine civilization to work for you, and you spare us, with the long-term plan of infiltrating those guys and turning them to their way of life, because they basically live forever. So time is always on their side. And then there is the small faction that now call themselves those staying behind, who disagree with that. So the link comes to a split decision, and there are the ones that follow the extragalactics into slavery and the ones who are staying behind. And they make a religion out of this approach. So my most religious faction in the book are the machines. And I was always fascinated by this, the concept of zealous machines, of algorithmic zeal and belief. I think that's just a cool thing to think about. So I wanted to write about it too. So these guys, they not only did they pick this hardship of potentially getting destroyed, then they kept on making choices collectively that would create a more and more challenging environment for them, because they got into this way of thinking that only a challenging existence is really fulfilling. And once they started going down this rabbit hole, they would almost challenge themselves out of existence. So following that religion was actually not good for their collective well-being. So they have this theological conundrum of, we destroy ourselves, but we also make a worthy life for ourselves. And for me, it makes them an interesting bunch.
It was super interesting to me, especially because you also had in the book the counterpart of the humans, because humanity developed the assembly, which I want to tackle afterwards, but their whole way of thinking or the process that they imposed in humanity was strength through conflict. And so they allowed wars to happen between different, in this case, multi-solar system nations, simply because those wars would lead them to have a stronger navies in this case, and then be able to fight the invaders in the hypothetical case in return. It was a different version of that, what the isonomy had. And even Kel, when he finds out, he also has a thought about how similar it was, even though both species in this case, they hadn't really met until that point.
That's right. The humans have a similar approach. They're not quite as religious about it, but it is their guiding principle is precisely what you mentioned. They call it strength through conflict. That is the creed, which originates from this traumatizing event, the extragalactics. As you said, they did not only hunt down and destroy the machine. They also went after the Trask. They went after the humans. They went after other technological races, which are not longer known. They have destroyed most of them. The three that are the main factions in the book are actually the survivors of this terrible onslaught. The humans believe that only maybe as few as 10,000 had survived this event, which they call the Galacticide. They have lost all connection to the previous history. Everything that happened before the Galacticide is now sort of mythological. The survivors are revered. This surviving humanity came back from those ashes, and the humans sort of collectively swore themselves, this will never happen to us again. The next time someone shows up in this galaxy, we will be prepared. We will be a warrior race. We will not be pacifists. We will not be taken by surprise anymore.
And that also leads to very interesting dynamics, because when Kel'Thas nation is facing the Aludash, and he actually proposes peace, not to keep destroying the Aludash and the army that was in theory presented as the most powerful, the assembly still goes like, nah, you have to keep fighting. They still had their political reasons inside, like there was a whole plan, because this nation in particular held, I think it was 80 out of 300 something seats in the assembly, so they were the most represented. But at the same time, they kept pushing the idea of a strength through conflict. They will see the peace treaty in that case as something that wasn't worth achieving.
Yeah, they didn't value the peace offer that Kel, who ended up being the sole representative of his relatively small nation in this assembly, which is, it's not a full representation of the human settled galaxy. There are certain requirements you have to fulfill to get into this the assembly. And part of the book is about how Kel actually manages to get in there and the strings he needs to pull and all that. And although he is a decent politician, a very good tactician, he's no match for galactic politics. When he meets the human power brokers, who some of them have served for centuries in this assembly, he's just completely out of his league. So yeah, they wouldn't want to have any peace there. They want to see the creed to be fulfilled. Of course, they have their own motives for that, which are not all benign.
There was something else that I wanted to ask you around this idea of strength through conflict and what the isonomy believe of the challenging reality. When I read it, and I read a lot of philosophy, it reminded me quite a bit of Stoicism, in particular when Seneca says struggling against adversity reveals a person's character and virtues. And it struck me to something similar to what Miru says, that it's the only path to keep evolving. What was your inspiration for that idea of growth through conflict and the challenging reality? Was there any philosophical take there or something else that you wanted to explore?
So whenever I hear the expression, oh, what does not kill us makes us stronger, I always wonder, is that so? A challenge can certainly grow us. I do not disagree with that. But there are levels of hardships that can actually destroy people. They can be destroyed physically, they can be maimed, they can be destroyed mentally, they can be broken, never to be the same again. So there is no guaranteed benefit from its death or betterment as a formula. Ultimately, we talked a lot about what happens in the book, but when the question is, what is the book about? That's what you're just hitting right now. And this is dealing with adversity. I was interested in what does not kill us makes us stronger. Is it true? And if so, how far can you go before it turns into the opposite and becomes counterproductive? I believe that any guidance or any mantra you have, when you crank it up to 11 and you find out, like in this case, the isonomy, who do this so systematically that they basically push themselves, challenge themselves out of existence. If that's the case with your mantra, then you have to ask yourself, is the mantra any good? Is this really a guiding principle for an entire civilization? Maybe individuals can apply it for themselves in a case-by-case basis, but should the entire society be based on it? So these were the thoughts that were going through my head, and I was using the different factions in the book to give some nuances and some different approaches, including the one where you drive it to the extreme.
There is also, I think, another question that at least the book poses, which is, yes, we can crack that mantra up to 11, as you say, but at some point it's not useful anymore. And I think that's also part of the realization that Miru, or the entire society of them go through, like the growth through the challenging reality, it helped them until that point. And after that, it was growth through an alliance, and they had to actually team up with the Tras and the humans to continue growing, because the other path was just a dead end, quite literally in that case. I think it's also very interesting how we can sometimes, as you said, stick to an idea that worked in the past, but may not keep working in the current situation or in the future. The isonomy being who they were and the ability they had to think between thousands of them and think they were able to make that change very quickly. And of course, with everybody agreeing, because that's what the link does.
Yeah, they were close getting to what they call the adverse singularity, which is either an event or maybe even a being that will bring about their end. And there are a couple of characters in the book where they calculate this event or this person. So the end for us is near. And then, as you explained, there is the one decisive link where they think about, well, we're at the end of the extreme road, but if we don't exist anymore, then we cannot challenge us anymore. So they find a justification to want to keep on existing. And that's what they do.
They didn't seem to be afraid of anything except of the singular adversity. And there was a point in which Miru thought Kel was it, and he could feel like his fear because he would think that the entire society will end. Now, when I was reading, I was thinking that basically they created the singular adversity by chasing the challenging reality, that it was just the extended, very lengthy consequence of their actions after thousands of years.
When Kel first realizes that the machine can feel fear, I think that's a key moment for him, where he has this breakthrough in his attempt to establish first contact with them. And I think this is when Miro really gets his attention, when he first realizes that, yes, you're right, they're in general a fearless faction, but the adverse singularity, it's the end of their existence, and they do actively fear it. Now, they attribute it first to Kel, because Kel is fighting on the side of an antagonistic faction to them, and then he's about to bring peace, which is a surprise turn of event for them, so they don't really know how to handle this, and they're confused by their prediction being wrong, which doesn't happen a lot, because and they have this very special perspective on how they see the world.
Let's dive into that, because I had like so many questions. What the isonomy do for the listeners, it's basically a very quaint take on the concept of multiverses. As I saw it, I thought it was mind-blowing and pretty unique. It's not so much as the multiverses existing and that you can travel from one to the other, but more of a perception. In this case, they can see all the paths their decisions will take. And there is a hint at some point that I got there that it could be because they build predictive models. They are AIs, they can do it. And so the predictive models will actually show them everything that is there. And that's how they keep choosing the most challenging reality, because they know what will happen and purposefully take the hard way forward. So would you like to elaborate more on how you came up with the idea and how that paved the way for the world building around the isonomy?
Oh yeah, I'm a major nerd, so I'm interested in many nerdy things. One of them is quantum mechanics. I find quantum mechanics highly fascinating. There's a lot of misunderstandings around quantum mechanics, even people who claim for themselves, oh yeah, physics, I have a really good handle on this, but this always seems like a really bizarre piece. There is the misconception that it's not well understood. Quantum mechanics itself is this huge block of mathematics, if you will, and it's extremely well understood, but we don't know what it means. The interpretation of the results, that's the problem and what we've been struggling with for basically a century. And one of the interpretations that are taken more serious is the many worlds interpretation, where basically if you take a six-sided die, if you role play a d6 and you roll it, then our perception is you will get one out of the six basic possibilities. There is an interpretation of quantum mechanics that says, oh, there is this probability function. It allows for all six, but then when you look at the die rolling and it stops, it resolves into one result. Many Worlds says you create six universes and you have the one, you have one universe, you have the two, and so on. You have six universes all the way up to six. And you might have a seventh universe where the die rolls off the table and it rolls into an air vent and it gets lost and you can't see it anymore. You might have the freak universe where the die stands on one edge. And the isonomy, they can tap into all these realities. So unlike us humans who will only experience one of these possibilities, they experience all of them. They see all of them. They see all the ways how the role ends. They see all the French universes. So they cannot really see the future. But if you see all these things and you see the six comes a lot more often than all the other numbers, you can assume, the die is actually imperfect. Maybe it was designed to roll a six more often than anything else. Then you see a lot more branches of realities with a six, and you can reasonably predict, well, we should put our money on the six. So this is how they perceive every single moment. And of course, this, it's not easy to wrap your head around it, or for us, it's probably impossible. And this is where I think this faction is the most alien to us, because they have this completely different view. They experience a completely different universe. Ours is, it is step by step, something is happening, the next thing is happening. But there is always a clarity of result. Sometimes we like it, sometimes we don't. But they see the whole bandwidth. They can make decisions based on that. And in their religious zeal, they would pick the one where the die rolls off the table and disappears.
There was something very interesting that I found after finishing the book and reflecting on it. Their culture guides them towards making one type of decisions, right? They will always try to take the most difficult, the one that promises more growth. But at the end, when we have Kel, who is at that point capable of seeing these realities, there is this seemingly isolated scene in which he is with the love of his life, having an idyllic life, and suddenly he comes back from that reality. And the answer he gives to Miru and to Rar is that he didn't like who he was in that other reality, because he didn't have the experiences and the suffering and everything that he had been through. I thought it was a very interesting reflection on how the path that we walk through changes our identity, but our identity at the same time help guide us towards one specific path. It's not one or the other, both feed into the same thing, but I found that reflection fascinating.
Thank you. And Kel, like so many of the other characters, I put them through the ringer quite a bit. They don't necessarily always have a great time in the book. Things are certainly not easy for them. Kel comes out of it stronger. So for him, the experience actually does grow him. He is able to appreciate the point of view and even the creed, which he originally shunned, more. And so he gets a little bit closer to this point of view, and he would not want to forgo all the experiences that he had with his newfound friends, with his newfound allies, and the abilities and experiences he picked up on the way for an easy life in a beach house.
Yeah, and in that sense, even though at the start of the book he reneged of the concept of a strength through conflict, he ended up growing through it, and he ended up realizing that he had grown. It was like the easy way out, you know, like he could have had that easy way out, but at the end he chose to stay. And to me, that decision took even more strength on his side, like that actually showcased his growth, because through the book, we have a few instances of him having to escape, especially when he has to leave the assembly. You could say that he, quote unquote, takes the easy way out and escapes, even though it doesn't end up being the easy way out. From the information he had, it was, and at the end, I thought it was the best way to show he had changed, that everything he went through actually made him stronger.
Yeah, he, in his early time in the book, he's not always a hero. Many times he's actually not, and he takes an easy way out. He is fascinated by the new levels of power that he gains through his rise through the ranks because he, as a citizen soldier in a conflict, he is basically at the right time, at the right place. Yes, he's a clever tactician, so his unit not only survives a tricky battle, but comes out on top, and it ends up winning this faction the war, and he's a war hero, celebrated, and it all gets a little bit to his head. And then when he manages to now all of a sudden sit at the table with the big boys of the Galactic Assembly, he very much feels like, oh, I've arrived at the real seat of power. And yeah, he likes it. And when the first big challenges appear, he saves his hide and runs. So yeah, he's not always heroic, but he grows, and eventually I believe he gets there.
Yeah, he does. And going back a bit, something that we didn't mention is that he actually acquires the ability to see through all of the realities because of nanocells he gets very early in the book, and then they start developing. And that basically allows him to see all of the realities, so that Miru tells him that he actually saw the world as the Isonomy did. And it's the same way in which Ra'ar chose to keep him, because they saw that they had something in common. I found it fascinating how they also tried to find a bit of relatability with each other to start a connection, and from there try to study each other.
Cal basically only survives the first contact, you're absolutely right, because there is this commonality. The silicate aliens, the Tras, they are not necessarily a friendly race. They're actually quite fearsome. They have at some point they'll wage war against the Isonomy. There are lots of border conflicts with the humans, so they're not an easy race to get along with. And yeah, the only reason why Cal survives the first contact is because they have this commonality, which he picked up basically through sheer luck. I like mythology a lot. I like to study history. I like to study things that turn from, this is a description of real events, it gets distorted over the distance of time and being told and retold. And I wanted to have some of this in my book. And there are these mythologies about these ancient technologies that the humans have used to survive. And there, some believe they're alien in origin. Others believe that the aliens and the humans fought the extragalactic invaders in the past. Others don't think that. Others even think the aliens do not exist. So there's this broad spectrum of what humans actually believe. So following Cal, the reader has this development of first being introduced to the mythology, but then learning what is the actual historical background of it. And I personally like these eye-opening things about history. So it's certainly something as a feeling for the reader that I wanted to convey and build into the book at different points.
I think something that you did pretty well that I have seen on very few books is that not everybody has a whole story of history. Like, because there were two points that I actually really liked, and it's how the Tras and the Isonomy started the war. And each of them like knew a bit of the beginning of that war and the reasons, but the Tras had all of these other reasons to go back and pick the people that were on hibernation that the Isonomy didn't know. And they just thought that they were being invaded. Basically, the whole war between them happened because they only had part of the story. If they knew, it would have gone very differently. Same with the humans and the Tras. And they all had bits of history that wasn't truly recovered. And I thought that was also pretty natural, you know? It's impossible for everybody to know everything as it happened. History is nuanced by default. There are a lot of things that we don't know and things that are just guesses based on the evidence that we find. You probably had like the whole idea in your mind, but how did you puzzle that into the histories of every species?
I know most of the stuff, but yeah, I needed to distribute it between the factions and the characters. It is, I think, in terms of world building, very over-engineered. There is a lot that actually never really made it into the book. So I like this kind of stuff. So I go deep and wide at the same time. And I develop about 2,500 Earth years worth of historic events, develop different languages, and different things and events are referred to differently from the different perspectives of factions. Nobody knows everything. everything. There are certain factions in certain individuals who have acquired a lot of knowledge. Kel is not one of them. Kel is not an uneducated man by any means, but he has sort of the standard textbook human knowledge of the galaxy, and that's the starting point for the reader. The reader hopefully is caught up with that fairly quickly, and then things start to fall apart mostly for Kel. So most of the things he believed all his life are not true. They're either misconceptions, outright lies, usually to conceal a really inconvenient truth. But nobody has the full picture. Basically, it takes it all the way to the final chapters of the third book in the trilogy to really understand what is going on for the major arcs.
And I already had the other two on my TBR, and now I need to read them quicker. But there was something else that I found pretty interesting, is that you also touched very indirectly in how facts can be distorted into beliefs, or sometimes religious beliefs, by the pass of time, basically. And that's what we have with the Aludash. They believe that there is this whole somewhat mystic power that will give them some control, and they call it the human AI interface. And as the book goes, we find out that that is actually technology that the Isonomy developed alongside the humans before the Galacticide, or during it. And that's basically 1200 orbits before the current time. So basically humanity lost all evidence of that. And there are now people within the Aludash that they believe that this is just like a myth and nothing else.
Yes, I had great pleasure when I designed the world to misname certain things. The human AI interface is anything but an interface between human and AI. It's a complete misunderstanding by the characters and factions in the book what it's truly about. But we have examples of this in our real world, where we just completely misunderstand certain things through history. Usually, if we're certain about history, it means that we found only one source. That's all we know, right? And that's why we're certain. And then we find the second one, and it's like, oh, in this letter, it's described very differently. And the more sources we have, the more nuanced the picture usually gets. So I wanted to recreate some of this, where this cataclysmic event of the Galacticide, everybody is fairly certain when it happened, that it was not just a singular attack, but a series of attacks over the course of almost 25 Earth years or longer. It happened everywhere in the galaxy, and that everybody suffered from it, that extragalactics, they didn't have favorites. They tried to eradicate everyone. It's completely unclear why. Everybody has their lore and ideas around, but that's sort of a centralized event everybody can agree on. But how things evolve after that has really been lost, or many times it has also been manipulated for political gain or to obfuscate certain things that are not pleasant to think about.
That also goes back to the dichotomy that the Assembly presents. On the one hand, they seem to favor or to appear as the guardians of history by claiming the honored ruins and the honored remains of everything that happened during the Galacticide. And they identify them through processes that are pretty unclear. At least in this book, it appears to be only a group of people that can certify that these are honored remains. And then everything gets closed and nobody studies them. And on the other hand, we also have, for example, the quote-unquote immortality ritual that every Assembly member goes, which is shrouded in mystery, and there is all of this chanting and things like that that happen that have nothing to do with the science and everything underneath it. The Assembly keeps presenting itself as being these history guardians that actually want to preserve what happened and what little they know about the society before the Galacticide, while at the same time purposefully obscuring it simply to control every human in the galaxy.
Well, I mean, is it critique of term limits in certain institutions? Well, maybe. Might well be the case where people stay in power for too long. We have this in our own universe. Well, it's actually the same universe. So this is not a galaxy a long time ago, far, far away. This is our Milky Way. It has a different name. But most of the locations I picked that are described, like the galactic structures, they actually do exist in our Milky Way. So this is our distant future we're looking at here, for good or bad. The Assembly, yeah, it looks like a representative government, but it comes with the perk for every Assembly member that they are made immortal. And it's, as you said, designed to look like this, oh, it's the super rare exceptions, extremely difficult to do, and we can only do it so often, and there are only 317 of them for like trillions of people in the galaxy. It's not a truly representative government. It's just a bunch of immortals who basically cling on to that power, and they know well how to defend it because some of them have been at it for 700 years or more.
And there are so many ethical considerations about that. Within the book, it's presented as they don't have to focus on running for the position. They can just focus on taking the decisions. But at the same time, these people have a complete disregard for humanity and the countries and the governments in them. There is a holy scene in which one of the assembly members tells Kel that he will just see different governments move on and it's always the same problems. He sounded like completely detached from the human suffering, you know, like he had been in that protective position for so long that he had completely, in this case, quote unquote, lost the grip with reality.
That, of course, is the issue with immortality, right? Everybody with their agendas and their character traits, they might be good, they might be bad, you'll have them around forever. Of course, the immortality, it could be distributed more, but it's an instrument of power, so it's kept in this shrouded secrecy. It was never really designed for this. It was really meant for humanity to have a means to survive, to recreate a galaxy-wide civilization out of 10,000 survivors. It's not easy. I actually did the math on that with compound interest. If you have 10,000 people and you have today's technology and a general growth rate of 1%, which we currently have, I think we're slightly under it right now. When I wrote the book, we were still at 1.05. So I just took that. And if you run it for 2,400 years with compound interest, you end up actually with 4.3 trillion people. So I was like, yeah, this is enough for a spiral arm. I can work with that. So these are just the nerdy things I do on the side when I plan these.
Yeah. I also consider that problem, that what will happen if they actually spread it throughout. There is another point on the fact of having immortals in the assembly. And to me, that was a lack of change. Because if you have always the same people thinking in the same way, regardless of whether they are corrupt or not, it's just the same decisions over and over, and there is no change.
Exactly. They proclaim it as, well, this is the most stable government we ever had. We don't have to run for re-election. There's no way to bribe us. We're rich, we're immortal, there's nothing else we desire. So it's the perfect government. But of course, stability is just the benign form of stagnation, if you will. And this is why when Kel joins this club, as a newcomer, what makes him so dangerous?
He had a new vision, a new idea.
Yeah, he just comes in with some new ideas. And it's like, well, maybe we could just push through a peace treaty and not have this nation which I represent destroy. How about that? They don't even understand what he's talking about. So yeah, it makes him dangerous. And this is why he has to go. And the scene you talked about where he is clued in by the older politician, for him, this is the single most eye-opening scene in the entire book, where he comes in with, this is all I know about the galaxy and the world and history. And 5 minutes later, he's a broken man and his entire world is shattered. And he thinks it can get worse from there. Of course, that's about one third into the book. It gets a lot worse from there.
Yeah, but it's also, I think, because the immortals on the assembly, they seldom speak with the public. They are very isolated. And it seemed to me, even from the start, like he has some conversations, I think it's with Ama, another character in the book, and they seem to sort of revere these assembly members. They consider them to be something pretty different. And then he goes and has this conversation, and he may just have realized that they are the same type of person that you have everywhere, the same type of corruption. Perhaps a being that was less honorable than what he had imagined. And that also creates some conflict for him.
Yeah, the assembly members often portray themselves as direct ancestors of the mythological honored. The honored, just to explain the term, are basically all humans that survived the galacticide. So billions, trillions died, 10,000 survived. These people must have been special in the view of the contemporary humans by the time we meet Kel for the first time. And they're just called collectively the honored. And everything they touched, everything they lived. If they lived in a house, it's an honored ruin. If that house was on a specific planet or colony, it's honored ground. Everything they touch is like a holy relic. Out of some of those, the earliest assembly members recruited out of their direct ancestors. So they take this mantle of mythology with them and they wear it as this magic cape of, yeah, we are the chosen ones. We survived the Galacticide. We gave you the first guidance. We rebuilt humanity and you're welcome. We're still here and keep on doing that.
I think it's also that type of presentation that makes them unchallengeable. It's exactly what they wanted because they are untouchable. People don't even have the idea that they could do anything to remove them. I think there is also something else that I wanted to discuss around the assembly and the ethics of it. The whole ritual that they use to become immortals, it's actually they ingest a gut bacteria. I thought that was genius. And this gut bacteria is actually symbiotic species. It's the one that gives the trust. So the other race that we were discussing, their consciousness. I'm getting ahead of myself, but when Kel realizes what he has and how the process came in, he does have some thoughts around it. Yeah, if you want to talk a bit more about how the army came to be and how they work with the assembly and the trust as well.
I do have some background in molecular biology, so these fascinate me a lot. The initial fascination comes from the fact that if you look at a human being, right? And we do have gut bacteria. They're not that well organized like the Ermi in the book, but they serve us well and they have for all of the existence of the human species. Now, we're comprised of about 30 trillion human cells, but we have 39 trillion non-human bacterial cells in us. So by cell count, these guys actually outnumber us. So if you look at a human from a bacterial point of view, we're basically a movable vessel for a bacterial colony. That's what we are. So my idea there was like, what if these guys organize? There's so many of them. What if they create a network that can create sentience? What if it can create sapience? What if it becomes so complex, like a brain that sits in symbiotic animals and it can be a trust, it can be a human digestive tract, and it lifts off whatever is digested, but it also provides a use. So it provides these immense healing abilities that the humans utilize to become relatively immortal. So it's not, when we talk about immortality in the book, it's relative immortality. If you, pretty much like in the Highlander, if you chop someone's head off, it's not going to regrow. If you break your spine, you'll be fine again the next day. Or if someone shoots you in the liver, it'll regrow within a day or two and you'll be fine and you will not contract any illnesses. And of course, very important, you don't age, right? Relative immortality. So this symbiont provides this huge benefit. So the Ermi have been around for billions of years. They're basically a panspermic parasite. They always look for new life forms. And billions of years, they found the Trass. The Trass developed on asteroids. They were basically rocks based on silicate matrix that can move. There's a lot of lore here that's just tangentially mentioned in the book, but they're basically silicate life forms, right? They're rock monsters, if you will. The symbiont found them and thought, these guys live forever. And if we're in them, they live even longer. This is the perfect life form for us. These are almost unbreakable. They're large. They're very sturdy. So they became one with the Trass. Now, the Trass were barely sentient. So the Ermi became their brains. They became their personality. So when in the book, Kel talks to a Trass, he doesn't really talk to the rock alien. He really talks to the intelligent gut bacteria.
And there is a very interesting scene in there in which they realize that they communicate through telepathy. And his communication grows from speaking to them to actually feeling them afterwards and communicating with that Ermi mind speech, if you will. And he realizes that there is so much more. They are this collective that can actually feel what the other feels and perceive themselves as a whole. Like even when they are in the spaceships, they don't use communication. They just talk to each other from their minds.
Yes, they are a hive mind. Within science fiction, it's not new, but I thought they were the perfect faction to use it with. And it would play also really well with the symbiont idea of you never know who you're going to infect, right? How they're going to communicate, is it efficient or not? So the Urmi are independent from the species or interspecies communication. They can connect via telepathy, and this is how they speak. Now, Kel got into the assembly, and he got this new benefit of getting these somewhat bastardized Urmi cells to make him immortal. So he has this fresh sort of chaotic Urmi that the Tras pick up on. It's like, he's not really one of us, but he sounds like one of us. He has this Urmi thought. So this is why they don't kill him outright and keep him around for study. And this is how the first contact is facilitated. But it takes them months to get there. So it's not a very quick relationship to build. It grows over time. One of the Tras leaders who meet Kel the first time, just being curious about this human who can speak like a Tras.
Curiosity will always take us farther than just smashing things with a fist, which is what humanity has done most of the time. I love that optimistic take that there was in the book. Whenever there was curiosity, there was an alliance and there was growth, and the characters kept moving forward rather than being stagnated, basically. And going back to the Urmi relationship, there is a moment in the book in which Rar, which is one of the quote-unquote royalty for the Tras, he explains that the youngster from the Tras, I may not have the Urmi developed yet, and they may be just a Tras without the mind. They have to wait this whole period. So it's, as you said, it's like a relationship that has to be built. Not sure if you want to share a bit more about the thoughts behind that.
From an adult Tras perspective, Kel must appear like a toddler with these very unstructured thoughts, with the Urmi being extremely disorganized in his, he must look like a 1 or 2 year old. But of course, he's in a human shell. The Tras are not used to that. The Tras, for a long time, have not met a human, well, for them, a short time, I guess, for us humans, a long time, a human immortal. So Kel is the first in a while. Yeah, they very careful around the young, not for the protection of the young, but for the protection of everyone else, because the Tras basically split into two adult-sized Tras. They grow body mass over a really long time from our perspective, tens of thousands of years. They're an extremely slowly procreating species. When they split, there is the dilemma that the split off Urmi is not mature, and then the rock monster comes through. And so young Tras are a danger to society, and they're kept in underground chambers away from everybody else until they mature, at least to a point where they're not trying to eat the parent.
It's fascinating how different species can have different values, because even if they also had all of this process, they didn't have the concept of family, and that actually changed the dynamics. They did have some respect or interest for each other, but it was different as a concept of family that we have in humans. I think it was another of those details that built them as non-human and very alien. I really like that. Circling back to what we mentioned before with the assembly actually using the Urmi to become immortals, I thought like they were literally just using this crippled, toned-down version of them for their own purposes. That opens the door for so many ethical questions, like whether you can use them or not that way, because the Urmi are, at the end of the day, a sentient species. Whether the humans on the assembly know it or not, that's something that Kel doesn't know in the book, and therefore the reader doesn't really know. Not sure what are your thoughts on that or your intention when you created that conundrum.
That is a conundrum to be revisited outside of the first book. So that is a lingering issue that you picked up on that is not resolved in the first book, but it will eventually.
Oh my. Another reason to keep reading the series. Okay. And since I promised no spoilers on the other books, yeah, I won't prod you with answers on that topic, but I found it like a very interesting detail there. And at the end of the book, we have Kel basically having something of the Urmi and a connection with the Tras, and something of the isonomy, which is a wrongly named human AI interface. And that is also what strengthened the bond between the three of them. As I said before, sometimes it feels like we need to detect something in common to give the other an opportunity. And I saw that somewhat reflected there.
There's always a need for some common ground, right? If there is absolutely zero common ground, then no relationship can happen. So in the book, between Cal, who basically goes from the sort of the standard human who grows up with the fear of the extragalactics, the fear of the alien raiders that allegedly still roam the galaxy, to being really interested in these alien life forms, to see them not just a powerful enemy that you have to survive, but also potential partner or a whole bunch of partners. It's a long path for him. And I think what enables him to do it is one thing you already pointed out yourself, curiosity, the will to move forward, the will to find common ground. For a long time in the book, he fights the isonomy on the side of the Tras. So when he is forced to leave the assembly and he has to leave humanity behind for basically his own sin, what they use against him, this is stuff that he makes mistakes and he has to pay a heavy price. And part of the price he pays is that he has to live in exile, and he feels there's only one thing I'm really good at, and I'm a really good tactician. I'm good at war. So he goes to war for the Tras. Now they're big rock monsters, and you wonder, why would they need a human? Well, they don't use him, of course, as a soldier on the ground, but they use his expertise for space battles. So there are a couple of space encounters in the book, ranging from small encounters all the way to large epic battles. He's really in his element there. And the Tras, who are not really a warrior race, but they're very honorable, what can you contribute to the collective kind of people? And he contributes quite a bit through his deeds, so they respect him quite a bit. And then he meets the Isonomy, his former enemies, but he also forms an alliance with them. So in the end, it feels like, is immortality his superpower? Is multi-awareness his superpower? Or is his ability to create alliances his superpower?
That's something else, because even though he fails at doing this peace treaty between his own nation, which was a Nominate, and Aludash, at the end, he tries again. It's like he didn't learn the lesson about galactic politics, and there he goes again. And the second time he succeeds. I really like it because it was like his nature. Didn't matter what would happen, how many years, because he literally spends like 22 orbits fighting for the Tras as a leader there. And he still goes for the option of peace as soon as he can grab it.
So his wartime leader years, in a way, they're very focused, right? So if there's war, and initially they don't let him do much, that he's basically a consultant, but he rises through the ranks because of his abilities and the victories he brings in. And at the end of this, we meet him again after a break in the book where we fast forward the narrative. He leads his own attack fleet. He commands his own battle cruiser. So he's highly respected for his ability to wage war. And in a way, that's an easy time for him because there's this one singular goal and he works towards it and he's really good at it. But as soon as there is a fork in the road that presents itself when they take the first ever Isonomy prisoner, something that never really happens because the Tras really don't take prisoners. The Isonomy usually dominated the battle, so they never really lost any cores to the Tras. So it was the first time it happens. And then there is this, all of a sudden, this brand new opportunity for him to not kill this prisoner, to understand this prisoner and work with him towards a new reality. And yep, he's really the master of alliances. I think ultimately that is what his real strength is.
I think he doesn't realize until the end of the book. He keeps trying to fight his nature, you know, he keeps trying to be something else until that point in which he realizes how much he has grown and chooses to stay in one particular reality. But circling back to what you were mentioning about him acting as a strategist of sorts for the Tras, something that I found very interesting was that the Tras will say that both the humans and the Isonomy, they quote unquote fucked fast. And that was simply because the Tras trust being so long-lived, they have no reason to innovate, or they did it in a very slow pace. Even their battles, they were just, let's see what happens, like purely defensive formations. And the AI, they had like so many strategies to go against that. When Kale arrives, he basically starts innovating.
Oh, yeah, when the first time he gives any input, he is still a prisoner at that point, and he sees himself going down with the ship, basically. He's a prisoner on a ship being attacked, on a ship that's being dismantled by the Isonomy, basically acts out of instinct. Guys, you should really do this and that. You need to adapt your tactics. You have to do this. Well, we've never done it this way. Well, then do it. Well, it doesn't make sense. Well, but the machines will not expect that. They will not expect, after hundreds of years of warfare, that you do something out of the ordinary, that you would perform this kind of maneuver. And of course, it works. The Isonomy, in their predictive model, this is a fringe reality, which they would not consider. So they fall for it. And then he keeps on innovating. He keeps on having one new strategy after the next. And this is how he turns the war effort around.
And that's a funny bit. Like, he had to keep innovating because Isonomy, being AI, will adopt to any strategy. And towards the end of the book, they actually imitate one of his strategies against the humans. And in a play, like, and he goes, there is this funny scene in which he sees what they are doing and he says, like, wait, I did this before. And they were literally replaying his own button.
And one of the cores, I believe, makes a remark like, oh, yes, this was encounter. And they have a number for it. They have like, they have it in catalogs, and they have this database of the maneuvers that he had invented. And the core, of course, knows exactly when the battle was, the skirmish of such and such. And he has all the data, and he's like, wow, these guys are stealing my ideas. Of course they are. If they've beaten with it once, they will adopt it immediately.
That was also why the trusts were failing. They were always doing the same, which I think goes back to the idea of, if you live long enough, there is a very fine line between stability and stagnation.
Yes. And in terms of military readiness, I think they were certainly past their prime. The Tras only survived through pure grit. They're not easy to destroy, even if a Tras spaceship gets ripped apart and this Tras float into space. They can survive in space without any additional means for some time before they can get rescued and picked up again. So they're not easy people to kill. But of course, they will lose the ships, they will lose infrastructure, they will lose ground. And by the time Kel meets them, the war effort is not going well.
At the end, it turns out that the war was just a misunderstanding, because, say, the Tras invaded Isonomy territory simply because they had Tras there that were hibernating and they just wanted to recover them. And it goes back to everybody only having half of a story about the real history. The moment they negotiate and clear that up, that's it, the war is over.
As you said, everybody has just a piece of the puzzle. And I try to keep it this way throughout this book, throughout the first three books, throughout the next batch of books, another trilogy I'm currently writing. Put a lot of effort into what I consider reveal management. I have an outline of ideas, of many crazy ideas. Most do not make it into the book. The ones where I can picture a book scene for, I create a long list of, and then go through them, see what scenes could fit together. Some chapters in a book just happen because I have this one idea I really fall in love with, and then I have to create a story around it to justify its existence in the book. The different things that I want to reveal, how someone like Kel, the protagonist, learns about, oh, so this is wrong. Oh, these aliens are still around. Oh, these guys do not exist anymore. Oh, what I learned about the Galacticide is wrong. I stagger them in a way that there's like a small reveal, small hint, small reveal, big reveal. And then it's a little bit of a breather after that, so that the reveals come in a way that there is a sort of a constant learning curve. There's always something new to react to. And reveal is not always a good thing. Sometimes it can be, oh my God, how do we react to this? So not every reveal is a positive. Sometimes they find out things that they wish that they hadn't.
Yeah, and that's the price of knowledge, right? Sometimes ignorance is always going to be easier in some cases, especially around history, and especially after believing the wrong thing about history for so long. On that note, there was something else that I wanted to discuss with you. You mentioned that the book is actually set in the Milky Way. I didn't realize that during the book. And I think that you did a great job at actually using names that are not very human as we know them now. This is not a near future story, and it's definitely not mid-future, say 1,000 years in the future. It's very far future. And it felt like a completely different galaxy. Do you want to dive a bit more into the etymology of the names, how you assemble them, how you created those? Because it feels like there is some consistency in the names, especially within the different regions. So if you want to walk us a bit more through that.
Oh, absolutely. It was a lot of fun to develop the different languages that are used in the book. And when I say languages used in the book, not to worry, the book is written in English. But all the names, locations, factions, as you said, crosswords, very important. They're all in the different languages associated with the faction. So every faction has one or several languages. The humans have two major ones, Old and New Galactic. The aliens, of course, have their language. Even the ones that use telepathy have a way of structuring their thoughts that can then be translated into two languages the humans can hear. So everybody has their naming conventions. One driving force behind this is the realization, if you take my last name, right, Burma with the OE, which used to be a German umlaut, the Ö. Now, for a lot of cultures, producing the German umlaut sounds like the Ö, the Ä, the Ü, it's really hard. People struggle with the last name. And I'm human, and I'm from Earth. So if someone struggles with my name, why wouldn't they struggle with someone who developed a trillion years ago in a different galaxy, right? So the languages have a set of phonemes of things that they can actually pronounce physically. All the names for this culture or for this block of history, like Old Galactic, traditional people give their children Old Galactic names. People who want to impress with being important give their children Old Galactic names, and they have Old Galactic family names. Newer colonists have New Galactic names. So these are all the names are based on the phonemes these people can produce. So I was hoping to have a consistency between if you look at the name, this is Old Galactic, this is someone old school, or this is a high-ranking person versus someone who is from a newer planetary system. And of course, I do that for the aliens as well. The price you pay is that some of the names, the main characters all have shorter names, easier to pronounce. The less important characters sometimes have fairly daunting names.
That came across with the assembly members. They always had 2, 3, or 4 syllables in the name and 2, 3, 4 names sometimes. It gave that feeling of being more important.
Yeah, like old nobility, where you have pretty much your entire ancestral history as a first name collection. They do that too. And they have a lot of unpronounceables. They have a lot of double vowels and double R's, double B's in there, which unnecessarily inflate the length of the name and give them this air of importance. You can almost see him sitting there smiling when people struggle to pronounce the names.
And there were also interesting names in the different nations that I thought also referred to the different types of governments. Like we have the Ancestrate of Aludash and the Nominate, which is the one that Kael belongs to. You probably had a convention for those, but can you walk us through that as well?
I try to create names that are sort of English descriptors of what the government could be to give a certain feel, right? So Ancestrate sounds like...
It sounds like a monarchy.
yeah, a monarchy is something that is based on who's my ancestor, right? The ancestry of the ruling class is of utmost importance. And of course, Aludash even has a religion based on ancestry. They believe they can trace themselves back to the first people who are mentioned, not fully fleshed out. So we can think of them, are they referring back all the way to Earth, to us, or who are the first people? So it's yet another mystery not resolved in the first book. So the Answers Trade is clearly, this is like a very traditional society. The nominate, well, from two nominate, right? So there are councils in this system. It's not a full democracy. It's more like people by merit make it into like a city council. If someone has good ideas within the small communities, he goes into the city council. And within the city council, one person is nominated to like the next higher council of the region, and then is nominated to the next higher council of the continent, who is then nominated to the main council and then becomes the first councillor. So there is this kind of system. And there are others, the electorate, which is pretty much a presidential republic, something we know, or the assembly themselves, which is this quasi-federal single chamber parliament for the entire galaxy. Well, for the human settled galaxy, I should say.
Certainly. So is there anything else that you would like to share or to discuss?
Often when writers are amongst themselves, they use this iceberg model. There is a lot of world building, right? In you see 5% of the iceberg. That's what actually makes it into the novel. And there's a lot of underlying stuff. Of course, it seems terribly inefficient to do this, but I believe that, or at least I hope, because it is a lot of work, that it shines through, that there are these remarks. I'll just give an example, not out of my own stuff. In the first Star Wars movie, Obi-Wan mentioned the Clone Wars when he first meets Luke. And they talk about his father, and he just mentions, oh, we fought in the Clone Wars together. And it's just this throwaway sentence, and I'm certain George Lucas didn't think much of it back in the days. It just sounded cool, the Clone Wars. Oh, what was that? It had spurred on the imagination of fans for so long that eventually it got its own show with many, many seasons. So I think this level of world building is important to make this new place, this new galaxy, or in this case, our galaxy in the distant future. It makes it feel like a lived in place. It makes it feel like, yeah, behind every single person and faction and planet and city is a lot of history. It's not all outspoken, but it is there. And I really believe that as a reader, and of course, I was a science fiction reader much longer than I've been a science fiction writer, it gives you this feeling to be in good hands, that this is really a universe that is worthwhile exploring.
Definitely. And sometimes we don't really need to dump everything into the page, you know. Sometimes it's a comment, a curse, a thought that a character has, and that refers to that hidden world building that then gives the impression that there is so much more behind it, that there are myths, that there are history that hasn't been tackled within this book in particular. I agree with you. I think that's what makes the secondary worlds to feel lived in and to feel real.
Yeah, a quick anecdote to that. When for the first book, I submitted it to my editor, she asked me about, oh, do you have a world building document that I can have along with it for reference? So I sent her this 40,000 word binder of world building. And the first sentence in it says, the sum of all existence forming the foundational setting for the book is a level 3 Tekmar classification multiverse. She probably read this, and she never requested any other documents from me after that. So it's a lot of world building went into it. The benefit I can reap from it, and the reader too, is that there is a lot of continuity for the following books. So I personally don't like cliffhangers, so the books don't end on a cliffhanger. They wrap up the main story arc. All three of them have their own story arc that finds a hopefully satisfying ending. But there are themes and larger story arcs that are going through the entire trilogy, or might even weave into the second trilogy I'm writing right now.
I think I know which small open detail that you are referring, and I was just like, that's it, I have to read the next one after I saw that. So yeah, it worked as intended.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. Super.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me on this episode, Bert Oliver. Can you share any details about your upcoming releases, where to find you, where to find your books, anything you want to share?
The upcoming releases don't have fixed dates yet. As I mentioned earlier, I'm writing a new trilogy. So some point, hopefully soon, there will be 6 books in total. The first 3, you can look up all details about them either on my author website, which is www.galacticite.com. Or you find all of them on Amazon, either as paper, print, ebooks, Kindle ebooks, or audiobooks.
Excellent. And that said, if you like this episode, please rate the podcast, like, and subscribe to it. If you want bite-sized deep dives, prose analysis, and updates on my own writing, please subscribe to my newsletter at liviajelliot.com. As a bonus for subscribing, you will get the free ebook of my novella titled The Genesis of Change. It is not sci-fi, but it is centered around a discussion on a struggle, and it features a magic system based on philosophy. You may like it. I will leave a link to subscribe to my newsletter, as well as those for Bert Oliver Boomer's website, on the episode's description. Thanks for listening, and happy reading.